it's been one of the, in some ways, the coolest political oases. As the world is divided here on Earth, out in space, nations get along. There's like a zero-gravity detente. Throughout the Cold War, the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, Georgia, the snatching of Crimea, all that, Russia worked happily alongside the other members, as they have for more than 22 years, when the space station was put into orbit back in 1998, doing science and working together. But now Russia's basically saying, yeah, that's coming to an end. We can't get along in space either, and we're going to quit the International Space Station in 2024, and we're going to build our own. And someone that knows about this better than anybody is the former commander of the International Space Station. He's a young man. I think he's going to do well in the world. I think he's just, you may have heard of him. He's maybe just the most famous Canadian in the world. His name is Chris Hadfield, the great Canadian astronaut. Commander Hadfield, how are you, my friend?
Evan, it is great to be talking with you again. I'm doing fine. I trust you're having a good summer.
You know, you and I, usually we have a guitar jam session around Canada Day. I don't understand what's going on. You sort of ditched me after my, was I that bad when we played guitar together that you were like, it's over?
My band has a big concert down in South Texas next week. You're welcome to come and join us if you like on the 6th of August.
I don't want to lower your standards, Chris. What did you make of Russia's announcement to quit the International Space Station after 2024?
It's bombast and noise and posturing and just giving them a greater negotiating bar by saying something outrageous that everybody has to respond to. The new guy, his name is Yuri Borisov. He's been in the job 10 days, and he gave a briefing yesterday to Putin. And in it, he said, after 2024, we're going to leave the space station. We're going to build our own space station. And I mean, the reality is, everybody is going to leave the space station at some point after 2024. I mean, that's not a date at all. That's just sometime in the future, you know, the space station will be finished. And so, I mean, there's so many things that punch holes in him making that statement. But it does, I mean, obviously it got the world's attention and gives them a better chance to negotiate, you know, how they want to move forward internationally with all the other partners on the space station. You know, there's always been tension and every nation's got their own agenda. I mean, President Trump, he also said something exactly like that while he was president. We're going to pull out of the space station after 2024 and, you know, do other stuff. But just because you say something bombastic doesn't make it the truth. And that's what was going on yesterday.
Speaking of Chris Hadfield, the astronaut and the former commander of the International Space Station, take us up there. Like, when there's earthly tensions here on Earth and you're up there, is there a written rule or an unwritten rule, Chris Hadfield? Don't talk politics. Let's not talk Crimea. Let's not talk Ukraine. Let's not talk Afghanistan. Let's not talk Iraq. Let's not talk X or Y. Like, does it get political up there?
We're just a bunch of people up there, Evan. I mean, extremely highly trained and carefully selected, and a bunch of people who've got a vast amount of experience and competence and therefore confidence in what they're doing. But, you know, not a bunch of idiots up there. And I think one of the differences perhaps is we're not assaulted by the screaming daily headlines of all the various, you know, networks vying for attention. We're actually seeing the entire world in truth for what it truly is 16 times a day. You go around, you see almost 8 billion people every day. And that tends to put the hot spots, the places where there's friction, whether it's as serious as the loss of life that's going on in Ukraine or just spats, it puts it all into perspective. And so obviously we don't ignore it, but the reality is we're a very small group of people running hundreds of experiments on behalf of everybody, counting on each other with our lives. And the politics and the noises and the political posturing, those all come and go on a regular basis. We have a job to do up there, and that's what we pay attention to.
Speaking of Chris Hadfield, it's fascinating. You have to work very closely with the Russians, don't you?
I was NASA's director of operations in Russia for several years. I was the pilot of a Russian spaceship. I mean, I piloted a Soyuz. I speak Russian. I lived in Russia for 5 years. And I talked to the people on the space station this week. In fact, I was emailing back and forth with the space stations. Yeah, so I have,
You have a little knowledge of the Russian perspective, but I mean, you do. So what do they say when this happens, these tensions? Like, what do you mean, you're back channeling or saying, like, because I've always looked to your space program as a place of hope where we can get over these things and kind of learn to live together. You know Russia, you know the people, you know the scientists there. What's their sense of all this?
I think it's easy from the comfort and safety of Canada to look at Russia as some sort of monolith, as if it is one thing, you know, a giant bear on the horizon that, you know, we should be afraid of or scared of or treat as just a single entity. But it's not, you know, it's, I don't know what the population, 190 million people or something. They're all different and they all have different objectives. Some of them support the current government is doing, and a lot of them do not support what the government's doing. And some people have a very short view of history, and some have a longer one. And so, you know, I really feel greatly for obviously the people of Ukraine who are dying and bearing the brunt of this, but also the people of Russia. The financial impact of this is going to affect them for a generation. It is the economic problems that are coming along with, and all the ways that other nations are applying leverage, it's going to have an enormous impact on the rank and file Russian people for a long time. That's the reality of it. And just because the current regime is doing horrific things doesn't mean there's any sort of unanimity of the people or of the crew on the space station. That's the right thing to be happening. So, you know, we're not in a position to affect that part of history from the spaceship. We need to do our part right. When something bad happens on Earth, we can talk about it. We console each other. We commiserate together. One of my crewmates, his mother died while we were on the space station. And so how, as a small group of people, do you deal with that? Or when your nation is doing something that you personally disagree with or whatever, you know, we just have to try and find the right path forward for our group to what we're doing up there and try and make sure that we're not of the problem.
I'm speaking to Chris Hadfield. And Chris, I know I got to take a break in about a minute and a half and you're going to stay with me. But I wonder if space is at a turning point, that you've got Elon Musk, they're flying NASA astronauts. You know, you're no longer needing to launch astronauts from Kazakhstan or any Russian territory. The Americans are back in the game. The Chinese are in the game. They want to build a space station. It almost seems like this is is it the privatization of space? Is there a space war? Like, is this a turning point in the space race?
Yeah, and what's driving that turning point, Evan, you're right, is it is because of a rapid advance of technology, where you used to have to be a trillionaire to fly in space. You used to have to be the Soviet Union or the United States. Nobody else could beat the technical challenge of it at any sort of economic cost. What has changed is the technology has gotten radically better and simpler and safer and therefore much, much cheaper. And we can talk about it here after the break, but that is opening up a whole bunch of new opportunities. Some of them, as you mentioned, geopolitical, but a lot of them just straight an opportunity to, you know, for betterment of life on Earth. And so, yeah, I think it's worth talking about.
Okay, so let's take a break. Chris Hadfield, Canadian astronaut, former commander of the International Space Station. Russia says they're going to pull out after 2024. Yeah, that's a lot of bluster. Everyone's going to eventually leave after 2024. It's a matter of when, as Chris Hadfield just said. But is this a turning point in space? What are the threats and what are the opportunities? Chris Hadfield's going to outline it. Next, I love this, an astronaut with us for another 15. So Russia decides to install a new chief to their space program, Yuri Borisov, and he comes out and he says, yeah, we're quitting the International Space Station after 2024, and the world pays attention. Is this the Cold War extending up into space and the cooperation's ending? Now, everyone's going to leave the space station eventually, but is this a turning point? Now, nobody knows this issue better than Chris Hadfield. You know him. He's an author. He's an astronaut, and he's the former commander of the International Space Station. He speaks Russian. He's lived in Russia. So this is about as core to his competency as anything in the world. And he joins us now. Chris, always a pleasure. For a lot of folks, did Russia's announcement send, like, does this signify that the space community and the International Space Station and what it symbolizes is at a crossroads?
I don't think so. This is just more of the same from Russia. We've been hearing their noisy chief of their space agency for the last couple of years. The reality, Evan, is that the Russians just put their biggest and most expensive and most capable piece, their laboratory, their huge laboratory, the size of a city bus, and with a big arm on the outside. They put it on the space station less than a year ago. And so they've just really gotten going. And the other thing is, the space station, the International Space Station, it is the crown jewel of the Russian space program. They don't have anything else. It's their version of the Hubble telescope and the James Webb Space Telescope. You know, that's all they got. And so for them to say, oh, we're going to leave the space station sometime after 2 years from now, that's an easy thing to say. But all the intergovernmental agreements and the memoranda of understanding and all the rest of it, you know, it's just they're chess players. And this is a really good chess move. It gets everybody to pay attention, but this is just, you know, noise. And the reality is, what are the actual actions that are going to be taken? But there is lots of change going on.
Yeah, what is going on, Chris? Because, you know, it just seems that space is changing. As you said, it's no longer just the purview of governments. It's private companies. The costs are going down. The geopolitics have changed to a commercial political element. There's opportunities and threats. What are the threats and what are the opportunities?
The big opportunity is that it is suddenly radically cheaper to put things into orbit around the world. So that opens up because of all the technology of the work of the last 60 years, as probably best evidenced by what SpaceX and Elon Musk's company is doing. If suddenly air travel was 25 times cheaper. So something that used to be $250 was now $10, or $2,500 is, you know, now $100. You know, a lot of people would change their travel habit. And so it opens up stuff like not just global positioning system, but weather forecasting and Starlink, where you can get internet from space, and understanding the world. We have hundreds of satellites, little ones, the size of a loaf of bread, that are mapping the entire world every day, letting everybody see the state of the world, measuring the actual reality of our planet so we can make good decisions. All that, and occasionally some wealthy person goes for a ride, but you know, that gets all the news, but that's just a tiny little piece of it. It's space commerce, and that's been, or at least very difficult before, with anybody but the government as a customer. But now, because the cost is so much lower, private businesses can be customers, and even right down to where an individual can be a customer and taking advantage of the cheap cost of transport. And so that's what's really changing. And you hear sort of ripples of it as something noteworthy happens, but it is shifting spaceflight dramatically, even taking us to the surface of the moon.
Has that made the International Space Station less relevant or more relevant?
Both. It's more relevant because it's the only game in town. The Chinese have a space station that they occasionally send people to that no other nations are a part of. But they're sort of about 25 years behind in that. But they're
What do you mean they're 25 years behind? What does that mean?
Well, it's like the Mir space station in the 80s and 90s. You know, I helped build the Russian space station Mir in 1995.
Right.
And it was small, didn't have very much power. And so it couldn't run too many experiments, but it led to all of the cooperation that allowed us to build the International Space Station that then is the most largest and most capable research platform and laboratory we've ever built out in space, and has been doing, everything from looking at the very structure of the universe itself to mapping and understanding our world like we've never understood it before, to all the other 200 experiments going on in the station. So it is a unique capability, but Naturally, as things get better, not many people are driving an Edsel anymore, or even a Model T. Model T was the best car in the world, but it got superseded by better technology. And so eventually, the launches and the robotics and the miniaturization of decision making with microcircuitry will allow us to have unpeopled space stations, doing stuff. If you can get there cheaply and your technology is good enough, you don't need a bunch of people on board to make it all work.
So
and
crazy.
So we'll go through that evolution, but it also opens up the moon. Bigger than Africa, untapped geological resource with no life, 400 billion liters of water, uninterrupted solar power. It's a really interesting destination for both science and for research and for eventually business. And if you can get there cheap enough, then suddenly you can change your mind about, that's a whole new game. And that's what's going on right now.
That's an expensive drink of water, but I know what you mean. I've got Chris Hadfield just for a couple more minutes. Can I get your reaction to the James Webb Space Telescope? The pictures coming back are so astounding. I just want to see it from your eyes, Chris, because you've been in space. Like, the idea that we are the only ones in the universe just seems ridiculous now when you see the number of galaxies out there.
You know, about 400 years ago, everybody had looked at the sky, but then Galileo built a little telescope, or had it built, and for the very first time looked at, like, Jupiter and saw moons around Jupiter. And the entire, everybody in the educated European world at the time gasped, like, we are not the center of the universe. Stuff goes around other stuff. How can that possibly be? I mean, he was treated as a religious heretic for it.
Yeah,
it took a huge society. It led a lot to, you know, sort of the revelation of society and awareness of our place in the universe. And that, to some degree, is happening again with James Webb. We have never been able to look out and see what actually exists and then try and work it into our own thinking. We've already, using the Canadian sensors on board, seen the atmosphere of a planet going around a star that isn't ours. We can actually see what the atmosphere is made of, do an analysis of it. If we can find a planet that has carbon dioxide and methane in it, as well as other gases, it's like, well, they probably have our kind of life there. You know, we're on the cusp of seeing that type of stuff. And so James Webb is like, it's almost like this magic look into the rest of everything else. And it's just the result of so many people's work, including Canada. Everybody should be proud of that.
Chris, before I let you go, Chris Hadfield, what's the go-to song right now? What is on the Chris Hadfield playlist, the go-to song? Because I know you're playing a lot of music now. What's quickly on your – because I've got a – Samantha and I, we love to run, lots of exercise. We're going to our go-to playlist. What's on the Hadfield playlist?
You know, one of my favorite artists is Brandi Carlile, and she has been touring with Joni Mitchell, who was a really formative voice for me growing up. And Joni just went back, both of them went back to one of the
Newport.
I think it was maybe the Newport.
It was
festival.
Newport. It was Newport, yeah.
And that, some of the songs, they did lots of songs on stage, but that is, to me, it's just magic. Brandi is such a great voice and a great force. And for her to, you know, obviously life moves on for all of us. But to get the two of them together on stage, Joni Mitchell is such a legendary songwriter and performer and knows everybody. To me, that is really
Oh, that was great. They did Both Sides Now. There was Joni. Brandi, just, she's incredible. And I think it was the Judge Sisters in the back. I don't know, it was Ashley, and she was bawling her eyes out.
To listen, everybody was. To listen to Joni digging in the singing, I could drink a case of you. To me, that was just, it's magic.
Chris Hadfield, you're magic. Thanks, brother. Appreciate it.